In the hierarchy of musical improbabilities, the tenuto mark reigns supreme. I don't know what that statement means, but it's written down on this paper without attribution, so it must mean something. I do know that the mark, not the paper,
all right,
can be interpreted as either an articulation or a dynamic mark. We'll come back to that in a minute, or maybe not. Visually, the tenuto mark resembles a cigar, yeah, or the left eyebrow of Anton Webern, sometimes both at the same time. Tenuto marks have symbiotic relationships with their host notes. Each benefits from the other's presence, no matter their wholly different musical organisms. A note without a tenuto mark is just a note. But a note with a tenuto mark is articulated and dynamic, sometimes handsomely so, and immediately appeals to the musician who values a value-added product. Coincidentally, Anton Webern was partial to tenuto marks, preferring them even to the cigar he often enjoyed while carefully affixing them, the marks, not the cigars, to notes on his score. When the tenuto mark is applied above a note, it acts like a protective cap or shield, warding off harmonics that may emanate from leaky notes attached to the staff directly over it. A tenuto mark placed under a note provides a measure of buoyancy so that the note doesn't sink in pitch. This mark obviously does not have a stellar track record among C-list musicians. The word tenuto derives from the fragments ten, meaning ten, and uto, which means count to.
Hold the note 10 times.
The musician who encounters a tenuto mark for the first time may be tempted to silently count to 10 before playing the next note.
Ah.
He would be wrong, of course, but it's always fun to watch a fledgling artiste screw up.
It certainly is.
If a tenuto mark is an articulation, which it is, and an articulation is the joint between a scorpion's cephalothorax and abdomen, which is also true, then it follows that C-list musicians who play Webern's music probably can't tell the difference between a scorpion and a cigar. Sigmund Freud knew something about cigars, having smoked them till he was blue in the face from oral cancer. He once said, "Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar."
In that case, that was not a very good one at all. One of those blueberry ones they give when there's babies made.
I see. Sigmund, meant, of course,
Sigmund,
that sometimes a cigar is just a tenuto mark. As mentioned back in the dawn of the first paragraph, a tenuto mark can also be interpreted as a measure of dynamics, such as magnetohydrodynamics. That is, the study of how an object, such as a cigar or a piano, moves through a fluid. Regrettably, there have not been enough studies involving pianos and fluidic materials for me to draw a conclusion worthy of this introductory essay.
Absolutely.
So I must postpone
just drawing on a bit,
discussing it further until another time, right after I uto 10. Maybe.
Yes, yes.
The importance of the tenuto mark is not lost on tonight's musical hosts, the Vermont Contemplative Music Ensemble.
They will be very contemplative tonight.
Why, their devotion to the symbol is so keen that they've named the whole concert after it.
The tenuto?
Sure, due to an administrative error, it's misspelled as tenuto.
Oh.
But once you hear how this articulation mark influences every single note they play tonight, as well as others they don't play,
that happens occasionally anyway,
you'll no longer doubt its import in, the hierarchy of musical improbabilities. And what could be more improbable than a couple of guys sitting before a couple of microphones, vamping syllogistic incongruities till the previously mentioned ensemble leaders have settled into their playing position?
Which they settled into awfully early tonight.
This is not a rhetorical question. We really are keen to know the answer. If you have one, or if you know someone who does, please have it sent to the only unnumbered house at the intersection of Calva's Causeway and Der Damienplatz, where we'll straightway take it
in the house.
A structure that serves as a conduit for this evening's entertainment, which commences as soon as the contestants tune their weapons. ¶¶
Night, and once again, the while I wait for you, cold wind, turns to rain. Covered with flowers. Instantly, I'd like to die in this dream of ours. Cicadas, how much longing in their song. Thank you. sounds of a temple bell reverberate in a circle a long night. VCME, joined by the incredible Brian Johnson there over on percussion. Good to see him here in town. We're Calvos and Damien. This is a radio show that's been around for about 15 years, and we now are off
the
air.
About 13 years too many.
Yeah, it could be. And we're now online as opposed to on the air now, so which is fun. And that's all we'll say about us. But let's talk really briefly about this great David Poyrzyk piece they're about to play.
You don't want to talk about the piece that we heard?
No. That, they can read the notes about that.
Yes.
Yes, that too is a remarkable piece.
If the composer doesn't show up, we don't talk about it.
Oh, come on now.
Beethoven, we're not talking a
never
thing
heard
about
of him.
Him.
Never heard
no,
of him.
No, we won't talk
no,
about him.
No, never
either.
Heard of him. In truth, the first one was amazing because it's one of the few pieces you've probably ever heard that starts at the loudest point and then quiets from there. Really quite amazing. But the new piece from David Poyrzyk, he'll talk to us later because we're going to hear this again in the second half. A remarkable piece. He'll tell us about the techniques used in this. It's in effect a piece made out of itself. A melody which is transformed internally, even though it's the same thing. It's really quite amazing. We won't say much more about it. We'll go right to it. Here it is, this Faubourdon.
Thank you.
That's my kind of piece. I really like that. See, I like these pieces that are intricately made out of themselves. I think that's a really, really incredible technique. We'll talk to him more about that. But now we're going to have Thomas L. Reed sit down with us. Tell us a little bit about that piece coming up.
Fortunately, we don't have a chair, so we'll have to stand.
Oh, no. We'll find him one. There's one there. That's the one that's likely to break. How about...
You want me over?
Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah.
That thing turned on?
It is indeed. It is hot. It is hot.
Yes, you again.
Yes, you again. Tell us about a couple of things. Tell us about the piece. But well, before we get to that, we're about to dive into your piece. You're going to be in your piece, and you've come out of someone else's. What is it like as a composer and a performer to make that transition from a piece which is not yours to a piece which is?
Well, it can give you pause.
Yes.
But you get used to doing that. Pick up the violin, pretend it's your piece that you played.
Yeah.
Now you're going to play another piece. It's almost as if the piece that I'm about to hear, I'll be hearing for the first time. I try to feel that.
Can you sort of separate yourself from your own piece as a performer?
I try to. Yeah. That's the fun of hearing a concert.
And if you have
your own music,
if you have a failing memory, it also
and that helps too. Yeah, you never know.
So tell us about this piece. This is also an intricate piece, but it has an entirely different feel.
Uh-huh. If you've read the program notes, there's a little line in there that says something about tonality, that it's not tonal, but it's going to sound tonal, because there are a lot of triads. They often just don't go where they normally go until the end of the piece.
Well, why do they go where they go?
Because at the end of the piece, they actually have to make an ending, a formal close at the end of the piece. So, but before that,
how did they
what's
get there?
Motivating the chords
is not
what we in the field call functional harmony so much. It's really voice leading, and it's rhythmic problems, rhythmic cycles that motivate the chords.
You don't approach your piece as a puzzle, though, do you? I mean, it certainly isn't sound that. Maybe I'm making assumptions.
Yeah, well, you first open the box and you shake out all those pieces. You know, even if they're assembled, you want to disassemble them and then see how they can be reassembled in an interesting way. Yeah, so it is like a puzzle at first, and in this particular piece, I really wanted it to be like a puzzle. That was part of the challenge, to see if the idea came to me from the story by Calvino, which is a story in which there are in fact 10 different stories that are begun in the course of this novel, and each one is interrupted because the reader. And Calvino addresses the reader of the book constantly as someone who has opened this book in the store, takes it home, and is about to enjoy a story. And the story gets going, and suddenly there's a page missing. So the reader takes the book back to the bookstore and says, "Look, you sold me a defective book. I want those pages because I'm really into this story." And he meets someone else at the store who has bought a different book which is also incomplete, so they exchange copies. and the protagonist goes home and begins to read the next story, and lo and behold, just at the most interesting moment, he turns the page and it's blank. But the next page has print on it, so he begins to read that page trying to imagine what was in the blank page. But when he turns that page, the next page is blank. So then he begins to notice that every other page in the entire book is blank. So that one goes back to the story. And this goes on through 10 different stories until finally at the end, all of the first lines of each of the stories get recited, as I recall, by the lady friend, who by now has become a very good lady friend, to the point where in the final scene, they're in bed together, and she says, "Why don't you turn out the light?" And he said, "No, I've finally gotten to the end of this wonderful story by Calvino, and I want to find out how it comes out." So the challenge that I had, I thought it would be interesting to try to do something like this musically, to actually write a piece where all of the compositions would be interrupted, simply wouldn't be completed, except for the last one. And the last one would actually be arrive at a formal closure. And of course, then the problem is that to make a piece which, when all is said and done, can somehow hang together. Just as the Calvino novel hangs together, I invite you to try to read it sometime, and you realize that despite all of this discontinuity that Calvino has put in the story, the whole thing just hangs together and has a wonderful kind of flow to it, from one thing to another, so that when you get to the end, suddenly you begin to make all of these connections. So
does that mean we actually have to pay attention when we're listening to this piece?
No, just enjoy the piece. There are actually good tunes in this piece. I had to write tunes because, you know.
Can we assume that the players towards the end won't all get into bed while you?
No, it doesn't happen.
Okay.
We left that out.
Okay. No, sometimes it comes.
And they're only, I forget, is it six? They're not 10 stories. Just, yeah, so they, so that's why you'll notice there are silences, and not to worry, the players are not lost. Sometimes the composer began to think, now what next? What next?
Your players await.
They await the ending, yes.
So, shall we hear?
Let's hear it.
Sure.
Would you like to tell us the title of the novel? The title of the novel is On a Winter's Night, a Traveler. Is that it?
It sounds right.
On a Winter's Night, if on a Winter's Night, a Traveler.
Yes, there it is, right in the
three dots. And that's the way it begins, with a mysterious traveler who gets off a train in every small town. And one thing leads to another, and he has this suitcase that he's trying to exchange with someone who gets off another train, begins to develop that his life is under threat. He may be a spy. He may be a terrorist. And that's where the blank page comes, so you never find out. Huh?
Thomas L. Reed, let's hear this new work. What story awaits its end? Thank you. That's what a composer does.
Hey,
wonderful performance.
He picks up his violin and gets ready to play the next tune.
Thomas L. Reed, Laurel Ann Maurer, and Stephen Klimowski and David Flaherty, they're playing that wonderful piece. There's an intermission now. Come back. There's some great stuff. There's also some CDs and books for sale in the back. Please grab some if you haven't. And another reason to come back for the second half, other than the fantastic music, is that you have to go through the second half to get to the goodies at the reception. So please come back, and we'll see you in a few minutes. You're listening to Calvus and Damien in the house on the Non-Pop International Network.